I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. There's just something about Cuba, the Caribbean island 90 miles off the southern coast of Florida, has been a worm in America's foreign policy apple since the late 19th century. Some American presidents have wanted to possess it. Others have wanted to control it. None could ignore it. How a tiny island took on such enormous diplomatic significance is a story of capital and communism, location and idealism, pluck and oppression. Today, Cuba and Castro are practically synonymous. But there's more to Cuba than the regime that's ruled it since 1959. There's a rich cultural heritage that no trade embargo could suppress. There's a unique spirit that's made tourism Cuba's biggest industry. And there's a seething anger beneath it all. The frustrations of a people playing host to the world's jet set while barely feeding themselves. Connection listeners, is it time to reconsider America's stance on Cuba? Or is there no time like the present to put the elusive Fidel Castro in his place? We're making the Cuba Connection this hour, and we want you to join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined on the line from Washington, D.C. now by Tom Gelton, National Public Radio's national security correspondent, who's covered Cuba since 1994. Tom, I gather you were there just 2 months ago. Just paint us a picture of what life is like there.
Well, Judy, I'd say whenever I go to Cuba, the impression that I have is of people struggling to make ends meet. I don't think that we in our comfortable lives can quite imagine how difficult it is for Cubans just to get by from day to day. And the vast majority of their energy and time and resources goes simply into this kind of survival struggle. That's one of the reasons why there's not much energy left for any kind of political activity or really even thinking about political issues or the wider world events. I mean, just for example, getting to and from work is a huge challenge. Transportation, public transportation, is very unreliable in Cuba. Finding food, I should say locating food, not buying food, but locating food is often a real struggle because the supply of food is very spotty. If you find out that chickens can be had at one location, then you have to figure out how to get there. It's just, the day-to-day survival struggles of people are just very time-consuming.
But it is not a country that looks so desperately poor completely, is it, Tom? I mean, there are two parallel economies here. There's a tourist economy where they can rent new cars, they can have fine French food and wines, they can stay in five-star hotels. Living beside this peso economy, people who are paying the equivalent of about 5 cents for a pizza and queuing up for it.
Right, that's right. And I'm not saying that people are starving. In fact, it's very uncommon to find evidence, for example, of a really severe malnutrition, as you would in many countries that are equally impoverished. The food is to be had. It's just that it takes a great deal of time and effort to find it. It's just a country that's just barely getting by in that sense.
And is it all due to the American embargo, or is it just mismanagement?
That's an issue that is debated, about which there are strong opinions on both sides. Cuba is not the only country that's been subject to economic sanctions. The American embargo on Cuba is a unilateral embargo. That means that only the United States takes part in it. And particularly now in this globalized economy, there are so many ways around it that I think it's increasingly difficult for Cuban authorities to blame all their economic problems on the embargo. It certainly makes things worse. But it's not hard to spend much time in Cuba and find evidence of tremendous mismanagement of the economy. This is an economy or a system that values political control so highly that objective often gets in the way of efficiency and sort of rational economic management. And it certainly would be easier for the Cuban government to provide more food and resources to its population with a different economic policy.
Now, you're there, Tom, in D.C. Bush is stepping up the rhetoric, perhaps because of his close links with Florida. I mean, how much difference is that going to make? Is Bush going to make a great deal of difference to life in Cuba?
I'd say right now that, you know, you mentioned at the open that you asked the question of whether it's time to reconsider U.S. policy in Cuba. People have been asking that question for so many years. I mean, to so many people, U.S. policy toward Cuba seems completely out of date. And yet the changes have been very few over the years. We found in the last administration, the Clinton administration, some important shifts. There's no sign yet that those shifts, and that would involve promoting more people-to-people contacts, being slightly more flexible on trade with Cuba. I haven't seen any evidence here yet that those shifts are going to be reversed. But on the other hand, neither do I see any evidence that they're going to be, that there's going to be more movement in that direction. For the moment, I see a real stalemate in U.S. policy toward Cuba with very little change anticipated under this administration.
One quick question as well, Tom, about your ability to work and operate as a journalist in Cuba. I know while setting up this program, we found it virtually impossible to find Cuban officials, Cuban government people, even people who were on the sort of Cuban desk of like organizations like the Organization of American States. I mean, how difficult is it to get Cubans to talk to you, an American reporter?
Well, I think one of the reasons that you've had this problem that you're mentioning is that there is a real sense, among Cuban authorities that they have to adhere to a particular line. And this is something that I have found the case in many authoritarian societies where they want to make sure that they don't stray from the official position of the government. And so there's a great reluctance to speak out or to be quoted, to be interviewed, without sort of the proper authorization from above. So that, in fact, does make it difficult. On the other hand, the Cuban government is fully aware of its need to project itself internationally. And I have found, Cuban officials to be accommodating of me when I do want to get a Cuban government point of view. It takes a little bit more time. It's a more bureaucratic process. You have to be patient. On every trip that I've made to Cuba, I have been able, in the end, to get an appropriate Cuban official to talk to me on the record, on tape, about the Cuban government's point of view on things, but it's a very cumbersome process, I think, because of this fear of being seen as speaking out in an independent manner. As far as Cuban people are concerned and working there as a journalist, I actually find it quite easy to work in Cuba. It's very difficult to get to Cuba. The Cuban government goes over your visa. Each and every time I go to Cuba, or any journalist, U.S. journalist, goes to Cuba, you have to get a particular journalist visa for that trip. The Cuban government considers those requests very carefully, and if they don't think that your visit coincides with their best interest, they won't give you a visa. But once you're there, I've actually found that it's not that difficult to get around.
Tom Sheldon, for the moment, thanks. Let's bring in now Jane Franklin, author of Cuba and the United States. Jane, welcome to the program. This obsession of the United States for Cuba, what would you see as the root cause?
Well, the United States has wanted to control Cuba since its very beginning. Thomas Jefferson tried to buy Cuba from Spain. Told his successor, James Madison, that with Cuba and Canada, the United States would have an empire for liberty. In 1823, John Quincy Adams, then the Secretary of State, later the President, said the quintessential policy toward Cuba, which was that Cuba was a fruit, an apple waiting to be ripe, to be picked, and that it could not fall to anybody but the Union to the north because Spain was out of its orbit.
Are you saying this is all about real estate, not about ideology?
It's about control. It's about the same thing that it's about now. This situation began long before the birth of the Soviet Union in 1917 with the Russian Revolution and goes on after the end of the Soviet Union. So it has nothing to do with communism or socialism. It has everything to do with control. The United States has overthrown many governments around the world, elected governments indeed, including in Guatemala and Chile. So Cuba has managed to seize control of its own destiny since 1959, and there has been a constant state of siege ever since the revolution began. And I'd like to read here from a memo, a State Department memo, 6 months after the revolution. If Cuba were deprived of its sugar quota privilege in the U.S. sugar market, which was soon done, by the way, quote, the sugar industry would promptly suffer an abrupt decline, causing widespread further unemployment. The large numbers of people thus forced out of work would begin to go hungry. And let me emphasize that word, hunger, because that's still the policy the United States is following with the Torricelli Act and the Helms-Burton Bill of the 1990s, which, by the way, both were Clinton-approved policies. In April 6, 1960, a year later, a document expands the aggression and is even more explicit. Quote, every possible means should be undertaken promptly to weaken the economic life of Cuba, to bring about hunger, desperation, and the overthrow of government.
You're making them sound, though, like perpetual victims. Surely Castro has done a few things over the years to really antagonize the United States.
Well, first of all, he took control of the country. You see, in 1898, when the United States intervened in the War of Independence, the Second War of Independence in Cuba, in what we call the Spanish-American War, and in what Cuba calls the U.S. intervention in their War of Independence, the United States had pledged in the Teller Amendment that it meant not to stay there, that it meant to give independence to the Cuban people, because that's what people here in this country had been pleading for. They were saying Cuba Libre. They wanted to fight for Cuban independence. That's what they thought they were going there to fight for.
Yes, but in the last 40 years, I mean, why did does Castro continue to annoy the United States so much when it is not a satellite state of the Soviet Union?
It's not a matter of annoying the United States. The Cubans do want control of their own country, and they're asking for trade on the basis of full equality, for instance, which the United States is not willing to grant. The United States is insisting that Cuba change its form of government, change its way of living in order for the trade embargo to be lifted. And the trade embargo has been there in its full force since 1962.
Jane, I'd like to just bring Tom quickly back. Tom, quick answer. Do Cubans blame the United States for most of their misery?
No, I don't think so. I will say, based on my many trips to Cuba, that it's very difficult to find a Cuban who is in favor of the U.S. embargo. I mean, they feel isolated. They certainly feel victimized by what even opponents of the government refer to as the economic blockade. So there's no question about that. On the other hand, I would say that, you know, Ms. Franklin says Cubans want control of their own
country. Tom, hold on to that thought. Yep. We'll come back to it after the break. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the Pariah Cuba Connection. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection at 11, C.S. Lewis. Advice from a senior...
I'm Judy Swallow. This is the Cuba Pariah Connection. Yes, number three on our list of baddies is Castro, the man successive administrations have loved to hate. He should have been a cinch to topple a guerrilla leader with a ragtag bunch of followers, yet through skill or luck he stayed at the helm. Why does he bug the U.S. so much? A question many a prominent American has asked.
So why are we so much tougher and rigid on a little country like Cuba and then carry on most favored nation trading status with China?
George McGovern, late senator from South Dakota, 800-423-8255, 800-423-8255. talk to join the Cuba Pariah Connection. My guests today are historian and author Jane Franklin and NPR's national security correspondent who's covered Cuba since 1994, Tom Gelton. Tom, you were talking about U.S.-Cuba relations and how bad they are and whether Cubans blame the U.S. before the break. Let's pick up that point. I mean, just imagine if an American spy plane landed on Cuban soil, how different the reaction might be.
Explain that question a bit. The reaction might be then
the way they'd handle it with China. I mean, in other words, what I'm getting at is how bad are relations between the U.S. and Cuba?
Well, relations between the United States and Cuba are bad. They've been bad for 40 years. I mean, this has become, you know, just sort of a fact of life in Cuba. The point I was going to make was to pick up on Jane Franklin's point that Cubans want control of their own country. I absolutely agree with that. However, I'd have to say, based on my visits to Cuba, that the vast majority of Cubans see the main impediment to that aim of gaining control of their own country, not as the United States and U.S. policy, but the rule of the Communist Party. It is hard to imagine how the Communist Party controls absolutely every aspect of life in Cuba. And for ordinary Cubans, they spend an awful lot of time trying to figure out how to get around these strict controls. If you want to rent a little room in your house, if you want to make a little, if you want to get a job, if you want to make some money on the side, you have to figure out how to get around Communist Party control. And that, you know, to say that Cubans have control of their own destiny is, I think, a real misstatement of the situation in Cuba, because Cubans do not have control of their own destiny, not so much because the United States somehow controls it, but because you have a small, powerful elite in the Cuban Communist Party that absolutely controls the country and controls everything that goes on inside Cuba.
Tom Gelton, thanks very much for joining us. Tom Gelton's NPR's national security correspondent in Washington, D.C., who also covers Cuba and has done for the last 7 years. Thanks very much, Tom. But let me bring in now Jesus Diaz, author and publisher of El Cuento, longtime Cuban exile. Jesus Diaz, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Jesus Diaz, I understand that when Castro came to power in 59, you were 17 years old. Initially, you welcomed him, didn't you?
That's right.
Why was that?
Well, because I thought that Castro's promise to solve all the problems of the country in a very short time will be right. And at the end, we will be a kind of utopia, you know. And that's why I agree and I work with the Castro revolution at the beginning.
Why did you then turn against him?
Because it was very difficult for me to understand that things were not so easy and that he, Castro, does not represent the opinion of a country. He was a dictatorship, a traditional dictatorship, Latin American dictatorship, and his real will was to maintain in power during all his life. Now, 42 years after his beginning triumph in 1959, we can see that's right. You know, he is in power, and his only will and his only desire is to keep in power till he die.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the Cuba Connection. Paul joins us. Paul, what do you think about Cuba?
Cuba is between a rock and a hard place. Cuba has right now Europeans invested quite heavily in the tourist industry, and they have learned to have what you call a dual economy. There's a dollar economy, and there's also the safety net economy, which I call the peso economy. Nobody in Cuba is starving. Nobody in Cuba, as somebody said a little while ago, is miserable. This is a country that produced some of the most spontaneous and beautiful singing groups. This is a country that has concentrates on sports and has done extremely well in baseball.
Have you been there, Paul?
I used to run sugar from Cuba to Boston before Castro came into power, and I was in Cuba in 1992.
1992, which is when the Soviet Union withdrew all its funds.
After that, they were having quite a bit of trouble at that time. But nevertheless, Cuba was determined to have an educated public. They had free hospitals. They had great medical training, and everyone now is educated.
Well, when you say they are very happy people, presumably you mean they're not starving. You heard earlier Tom Gelton talking about the suspicion, the difficulty of daily life, the total control of the communist regime. Did you not feel that as well?
Well, I know there's block committees, but unlike Mr. Gelson's idea, those block committees are democratic to some degree in that the people use them almost like we in a small town use town government. Town government responds to the needs of the people, and the Cubans may not have all the luxuries we have, but they're not in the terrible condition that the Haitians are in or the Nicaraguans are in after we destroyed that country.
Paul, thanks very much. I'll put that question to that point to Jesus Diaz. Jesus Diaz, you roundly condemned Castro, but isn't it the case that the communist regime has done a lot for the country? Improved health care, improved education, raised literacy.
I don't think so. They have done a lot. You know, in 1959, Cuba was the third country in Latin America, only after Argentina and Uruguay. And we have a huge development in education and also in health. Then after the break with the United States, Castro began to receive the aid of the Soviet Union because of political reasons, because of a reason of a coup connected or linked to the Cold War. But after the break, the fall down of the Soviet Union, then the situation is really difficult in Cuba. You can't have a freedom of association. You have not freedom of speech. They are not free press. So it's difficult to talk about a democracy in Cuba. And, I wonder why the Cuban youth tries to leave the country. There is a process of that I call a process of urbanization because the people does not believe in the possibilities of development for their own country. And then now I'm in Miami, here in the big Miami, live about 1 million Cubans, and abroad in Europe and Latin America, about other 1 million of Cubans are trying to leave as well.
Jane Franklin, can I bring you in here? What's your view on the track record of the communist government of Castro in Cuba?
It's an odd dictatorship that provides free health care and free education through the university level for its citizens. And at the same time, even under these difficult conditions of the last 10 years, has managed to create a medical school which brings people from Central America and Latin America and Africa on full scholarships to study medicine in Cuba. And now has U.S. students there for the first time. I just talked last week with a group of students who are going down to be among the first U.S. students at that medical school on full scholarships. They are agreeing to come back here when they're finished to bring their skills to communities that don't have proper medical care here in this country. And I'd like to point out there is starvation in this country. There is no starvation in Cuba. I'm not saying that Cuba is a paradise. I'm saying that this government, our government, should be working with Cuba to develop its health care and medical care.
Do you think that the U.S. has helped keep Castro in power? Because my impression when I was there was that he was a guy who over the decades could not believe his luck that he was still in power. You know, that he defeated the United States at the Bay of Pigs, that he'd stayed on, and that there was this incremental paranoia because of that.
Well, let me say that Fidel Castro has never had a chance to understand what might happen in a real election. In 1952, when he was running for Congress before the revolution, Fulgencio Batista, General Batista, was brought back by the CIA from Miami and overthrew the government and canceled those elections and suspended the Constitution. So Fidel Castro never got to know what it would be like to win or lose in an election.
Well, it's up to him to call it, isn't it?
Yes, and now let me say that the Helms-Burton Bill specifically says that neither Fidel Castro nor Raul Castro, his brother, may run in a U.S.-approved election that would then lead to ending the embargo. So obviously, some people in Congress, regardless of what we say about who approves of Castro and doesn't approve of him, some people in Congress, a majority, believe that he might win that election.
Jane Franklin, for the moment, thank you. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's bring in Berta. Berta, what do you think about Cuba?
Well, you know, I know that there are over a million Cubans in Miami, and I have to think that one of the reasons why we still have an embargo against Cuba may have to do with the heavy influence of the Cuban Americans in Miami. But if you look at that population, you'll see that the majority of the Cubans that are in Miami with a lot of political influence are either light-skinned or white-skinned people. And as far-reaching as this may seem, I have to think that, you know, part of the reason why there still is an embargo has to do with a bit of racism. You know, at one time, Cubans were allowed in this country who were professionals, the privilege, and the majority of the professionals in Cuba at the time were white Cubans. If you look at Cuba today, you know, there's a 95 or better literacy rate among people of all colors. You know, people get along regardless of skin color there. There's a lot of national pride. And I think that the Cubans in Miami, you know, would like to go back to Cuba and reclaim their property and you know, bring things back to the old status quo.
Berta, let's put that to Jane Franklin. Jane, is there an undercurrent of racism here, and is this really about politics in Miami?
Definitely. When the United States intervened in that War of Independence back in 1898, The rhetoric was very overt. I mean, people talked about how those people were like African savages and that they could not possibly control their own country and that we had to pacify Cuba until they were able to. So we turned a colony into a neo-colony. At that point, the number of slaves from the 19th century had made the population of Cuba a majority Afro-Cuban, rather, and not Euro-Cuban. So that situation still pertains today. And
so
on my first trip to Cuba, our guide was an Afro-Cuban woman whose two daughters were in medical school in Havana, and she was saying that before the revolution, her daughters could never have even gotten out of high school.
Let's put that point to Jesus Diaz. Jesus Diaz, Berta's point is that there's...
I studied in Havana in a free school from 1954 to 1959. And also the Cuban University was for free. So in the American intervention in 1898, the war was not solved in favor of Cuba, so... The American intervention, I think, that solved a problem for the Cuban population then.
But hey, so I think that the point that Bert is making is that now what is happening is the fairer-skinned exiles, well-educated in Miami, are sitting there waiting and trying to engineer the downfall of Castro so that they can go back and be the elite. Is that the plot?
The plot that if they don't go back in the future, then it will be very difficult for Cuba to have an economic development. I think it's a real luck for Cuba to be situated where it is, and the connection with the United States, for example, Mexico connection with the United States, I think it's a very good thing for Mexico. So I, as Cuban, prefer to be near to the United States than near to Russia, for example.
JCDS, thanks for the moment. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's bring Anna into the conversation, get a bird's eye view of what's going on there. Anna, I gather you've just been back to Cuba.
Well, 2 years ago, I returned to Cuba. My parents had left Cuba with our family when we were very young, in the late 60s, And
so just after the revolution?
Yeah, well, about 8 years after the revolution, in 67. And we had not been back until 2 years ago this month, as a matter of fact. I went back with my mother. I stayed with my family in downtown Havana, in a very nice section of downtown Havana. They're all very well educated and have access to not only our contributions quarterly, actually. We send money to them, dollars to them. But they also have access to dollars in a number of different ways that I don't really want to get into in case it should affect them. But
yes, there is the illegal sector, and everyone's a taxi driver, I know.
Yes, and so I was...
Were you appalled coming from a democratic country? I mean, did you feel this sort of stultifying communism?
In subtle ways, I did, and then in not-so-subtle ways. There was one anecdote that I wanted to share with your listeners because I found it to be heart-rending for us.
Mm-hmm.
We decided to take our cousins with us on an overnight trip as part of a tour of other Hispanic tourists from Argentina and Chile to Varadero, and we wanted them to stay with us overnight at this hotel. And the company, it's all run by the government, but they all have slightly different tour names, wouldn't allow them to stay with us in the hotel because they were Cuban and they weren't from, you know, outside of the country. And we argued and argued, and to such a point that my mother at one point on the bus tried to raise a ruckus with the by telling the story out loud to the guide and tried to get the rest of the bus involved in getting my cousins to be permitted to stay overnight.
And did you win the argument?
Oh, no. They ended up going back. And the last view I had of them that day was of them, you know, in the bus waving and smiling to us and leaving. But it was really heartbreaking for me because I wanted them to be able to go and eat at a buffet and to be able to have a drink by a pool or...
with their family. Anna, thanks very much for sharing that with
yes.
us. Castro is our pariah of the day, the man who drives America nuts. But what's the problem? Is it communism or real estate? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in hour number two of The Connection at 11, advice from a senior devil to a junior devil.
Judy Swallow, this is The Connection. There are 65,000 soldiers in the Cuban army. The defense budget is $720 million. Not a country to fear, surely, but to loathe? Is Castro the most useful enemy America has? Is the U.S. his? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests today are Yezu Diaz, author and publisher of El Cuento, and historian and author of Cuba and the United States, Jane Franklin. But let's go straight to a connection listener. David joins us on the line, and I gather, David, you're recently back from Cuba.
That's correct. I actually traveled to Cuba for a week, having just returned on Sunday. And I went down as a part of a study tour through Harvard University, and it was our events were planned in conjunction with the University of Havana. And this is an annual trip that Harvard, it's actually done through the John F. Kennedy School of Government, which I think has some irony to it.
How do you get there? I mean, you can't fly directly, surely?
No, we do. We're able to get visas through the State Department because it is an educational trip. And we go down as students to do research on various topics in the country.
And what were you researching?
I was researching the Cuban internet to the extent that it exists. because I think it's probably a fairly good example of access to information for citizens, and is quite telling of how restrictive the regime still is with information. It was very clear to us that the regime had no interest in our roaming the countryside talking to people about what goes on there. You know, there were some students studying the rights of the gay community. Other students were studying how dissidents were treated and things like that. our days were extremely structured. We were at the University of Havana almost every day, all day.
Did you get to go out at night? I mean, I was wondering what you thought about the street life, the nightlife, the music in every bar culture of Cuba.
Right. I mean, and that, you know, that's, there are some positive things about Cuba and the way things are handled. For example, there's absolutely no violence. You could go out until 3 o'clock in the morning and walk on the streets, and it's not just for tourists, it's everybody, which is unlike other Latin American countries that aren't under a communist rule.
Indeed. Was it what you expected from a communist country?
In some respects, yes. I had never been to a communist country before, and so I didn't expect the 6 hours a day of lectures that we were given by Cuban officials to be full of as much bunk as it was. As I mentioned, I was studying the internet, and you know, our speakers would say, people have access to email, they have access to the internet. I would raise my hand and say, does that mean that someone from Cuba can go on the internet and read the New York Times? And they said, well, of course. Well, it didn't take a whole lot of digging to find out that people only have access to email if they pay $5 for 3 hours of access. Now, keeping in mind that the average wage is $12 a month, and they do have access to the internet, but it's the Cuban national internet, not the World Wide Web.
David, what do you and your fellow students think about Castro? Are you fascinated by him, obsessed by him? And the funny thing about Cuba, isn't it, is that sort of Che is the cult figure. Che is the picture you see everywhere on every wall and every postcard.
That's
true. As if Castro sort of deflected popularity towards Che. He's sort of the public face of Castro.
Well, it's interesting. Everyone we ran into, no one mentions his name. They call him the old man. And people talk about the biological solution, that all the solutions for Cuba have to do with the death of Castro, because that's the only time things will ever change. But you're right. Che is everywhere. He's on postcards, and people, you know, you can tell who the tourists are because they walk around in the Che beret. We did not do that. But
did you wear the Castro fatigues?
No, we didn't do that either. We did buy Castro cigars, however. And see, that's the great thing about having going legally and having a visa, is you can bring cigars back into the country.
But in a word, what would you say is your view of Castro?
Extremely manipulative. Anyone that we asked, and you know, cab drivers, when you could get a Cuban alone and you would talk to them, you were warm to them, they would open up. And there was one question we always asked: who can you trust? And the answer was always the same: no one.
David, thank you very, very much. On that note, we'll leave it. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the Cuba Connection. Tony joins us from Fort Lauderdale in Florida. Tony.
Hi, how are you?
Hello? What's your point, Tony? Yeah.
Well, I was going to make one, but let me just start out by saying that as far as the Cuban leadership goes, if you look at pictures of the Politburo, the Council of Ministers, the top military people, you're struck by the fact that they're all overwhelmingly white, and this in a country which is two-thirds black or mulatto. So the fiction here is that race issues have been solved in Cuba. They've been solved to the extent that the government says that they're solved, and anyone who says anything to the contrary does so at their own peril. But now the point I really wanted to make is that at least since 1970, there have been a number of warming trends in U.S.-Cuban relations, which seemed to end with Castro taking some sort of provocative action, whether it was intervening in Angola, you know, sending a refugee offensive to the United States in 1980, or shooting down those civilian planes in 96.
So you're saying it suits Castro to keep relations ill with the United States. Let's put that to Jane Franklin. Jane, is that what's going on? Because there have been some peculiar twists and turns, haven't there? When the Pope was going to go to Cuba, lots of dissidents were released. Immediately after he left, lots of dissidents were rounded up. Does Castro provoke the U.S. intentionally to stay in power?
Let's take that intervention in Angola, for instance. Would this caller prefer that South Africa have won there? Because South Africa was very close to taking over Luanda when Cuba ended that war.
Well, right, but now we're talking about the Cold War, and yes, Cuba was allied with the Soviet Union.
The Soviet Union, in fact, did not approve of that and Castro and Cuba did it anyway, and then the Soviet Union had to capitulate. That was not a Soviet proxy army that was there. That was because of Cuba's feeling that African blood does run in their veins, and they do feel that, whether or not the leadership is primarily what this man calls white. In Cuba, white is a little different than here, but I can't get into that. There's no time for it. However, Nelson Mandela gives Cuba credit for his liberation from prison. And for that, when he went to Miami, he was refused the key to the city because he spoke of Cuba's love for people. And I want to point out that the United Nations, the last vote against this embargo, which was last fall, was 167-3. Three countries, the United States, Israel, and the Marshall Islands, wanted that embargo. 167 voted to end it. And the last Gallup poll that I've seen, it was one from 1999, said that 69% of the American people want improved relations with Cuba, want normalization of relations, and 51% want an end to the embargo.
Let's go to Jesus Diaz. Jesus Diaz, what do you think, to Tony's point, that Castro deliberately provokes the United States at key moments because he wants to keep relations bad?
Yes, because it's the only form that he has to stay in power. I think Castro has a lot of possibilities to solve a terrible economic Cuban situation without dealing with the problem of embargo of the U.S. He can let the Cubans to have little industries or little commerce, you know, or to have a private economic life. But there are two kinds of citizens in Cuba. The citizens who are connected or linked to power, who has dollars, or the whole population that has not this right. Castro let down two little planes with Clinton administration is in power when the Hamburton law was to be approved or not. I want to point out that I'm pretty much against the American embargo, because in my view, this is the only pretext that Castro has to show to the world.
So he can blame. So he can blame somebody.
Against the embargo.
So he can blame somebody is what you're saying. Tell me, Jesus, do you yearn to go back? I mean, what is it about Cuba you miss most?
Well, I miss most the sympathy of the population, the you know, the feel of living. And I have a hope that I can see a democratic Cuba before I die.
I wonder if you'd actually recognize the place, though, with these mega tourist centers. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Karen joins us from New York. Karen, hello. What do you think about Cuba?
Hi, I just came back from Cuba last Saturday. I had the opportunity to go as a quote-unquote tourist. I won't say how I got there, but we had a wonderful time. But I can't help but think or wonder, why did the Miami group want to keep this embargo going when an open relationship or even a softened relationship, once Castro is gone, could open up the doors much like what happened in Russia? Because these people are very repressed, but they know it, and they know that there's other alternatives, especially since the Russian downfall. They have suffered even more because Russia was their godfather, I guess you could say.
Are you saying they should sort of lay the ground for when Castro is gone? You seem to be implying that they can't have normal relations as long as he's there.
Exactly. He mainly because his ego is so big, and he won't allow it. But talking to the people who would talk to you, because you know, you've heard everyone say it's very difficult to get anybody to open up. When you ask them, okay, now his brother is next in line, what do you think of the brother? Nobody will give you a positive response, and they all seem to think or hint that the brother is definitely not the one that they want in power. So they're open to options, and I can't believe that the Miami group or the dissidents from Miami or that whatever, that they're not opening up to that possibility of the future.
Jane Franklin, let's talk about the succession. I mean, Raul Castro's brother is not acceptable to the United States. It might be a long time coming, but, I mean, what happens when Castro goes?
Yes. Well, Judy, let me say one thing before we get into that. I'd like to point out one thing that's missing from the program so far is that most of the Cuban Americans in Miami are not necessarily for this embargo anymore. There are many Cuban Americans, for instance, in Miami and New Jersey, all over this country, who are organizing against the embargo. So we should make that clear. As far as succession goes, it's not clear that Raul Castro is next in line after Fidel Castro. That has been said, but recently I've seen information that would tend to leave it much more open than that. But I'd like to get to this idea that Castro wants this embargo in order to stay in power. In 1959, when the revolution took power, 83% of the trade was with the United States. The United States withdrew that trade and forced Fidel Castro, and the recent declassified documents show it overtly, forced Castro toward the Soviet Union because they wanted an excuse to intervene, which they did, and it failed at the Bay of Pigs.
But just finally, anyway, if we come to the present day, I mean,
the present day, in 1991, when the Soviet Union fell apart, 83% of Cuban trade was with the Soviet Union. There was no one to fill that vacuum. The United States could have said then, okay, we really want to keep your medical system and your educational system going. We think it's great that you've concentrated on those things.
Okay,
we could learn from you here.
Jane Franklin, and mistakes of the past, but we're coming to the end of the program. I'd like to go to Jesus Diaz finally. Jesus Diaz, I mean, would it be unmitigated good news in your view if Castro felt, isn't there a danger because of these two economies you'd have a popular uprising?
I don't think so. I don't think it will be a popular uprising in Cuba. And dealing with the future, I think it depends on us, of what we Cubans are able to build in our own country. It depends on us.
And a final word about those countrymen of yours, a sort of plug, if you like, to the United States about Cubans. Lively people?
Yeah, I think we must have a good relationship with the United States. And for me, the example is Mexico. He's in the NAFTA, as Canada is. And I think that that's the natural destiny of Cuba.
To be part of NAFTA. Jesus Diaz, thank you very much for joining us. Jesus Diaz, author and Cuban dissident. You also heard Jane Franklin, historian and author of Cuba and the United States. Also joining us earlier was Tom Gelton, NPR's national security correspondent, who's covered Cuba since 1994. Connection listeners, you can continue the Cuba conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection.